Melody said.
It's a monster surge, and they send the expendable people for a reason. We'll shield the fort from the next attack, give them supplies, and let them fend off the one after by themselves. Then we let a supply run through. We can't have them regretting their decision, after all.
Chapter 33. The Hitting at a Bunch Plan. The original plan had been to sneak into the dam quickly and quietly in two small groups while the defences had been pulled away by the attack on the valley. From the outset, it was clear that the defences had been massively increased since Clive, Humphrey, and Sophie first scouted it out. Their intent had been to launch the operation immediately after their original surveillance. Travelling to reunite the team, meet Dawn, and then the start of the monster surge had caused extensive delays. The newly added presence of the constructs in such large numbers around the dam suggested either something had significantly changed or something important was happening. It was unlikely to be a reaction to leaking information about the attack on the valley, because there hadn't been time to emplace herds of constructs all through the territory approaching the dam. Guard squads of Purity Loyalists were stationed outside the entrances at each end of the dam. Each squad was made up of one silver leading some bronze rankers, and each squad was made short work of. Both teams needed to move fast because of the remaining constructs they had left behind. At the end of the dam, Belinda deftly negated the magic on the heavy security door and picked the mechanical lock. On the other, Clive and Sophie split those tasks between them. Both teams went inside and ruined the magic of the doors, sealing them shut against anyone trying to go through, friend or foe. The inside of the dam complex was cavernous, with huge open space and a ceiling that loomed high overhead. The dam spanned the entrance to a sprawling valley, and the dam's interior followed that line in a huge, arcing curve. The roof, walls, and floor were concrete, while huge devices of heavy industrial magic occupied the floor and stuck out from the walls. This was an artifice on the largest scale, the kind used by cities to manage the infrastructure that supported their great populations. Here it not only managed the water flow through the dam, but also the magic carried within that water, accumulated, refined, and repurposed. Plan A, stealth, had gone out the window before the two groups even reached the dam. Plan B, blitz past the diminished defences, was rendered laughable by defences that had been increased, not decreased. Purity loyalists were already bearing down on them. Some were clearly guards charging at them, others looked to be artificers who served as magical technicians. They were abandoning the infrastructure they were modifying and running in the other direction. At one end of the dam, Sophie dashed forward while Humphrey poured out a circle of bone powder from a bag. Clive and Onslow stood protectively in front of him as he summoned his dragon warriors and Stash leapt from his pocket. The shape-shifting little dragon turned from a mouse into a rune tortoise like Onslow. He couldn't match the full powers of the other familiar, especially when Onslow and Clive worked together, but he still made for a strong defensive bulwark. Humphrey took out a pair of 12-sided dice and rolled them in the circle of bone power. Light rose from the upturned faces of the dice, one projecting a glowing green line drawing of a crocodile's head. The other was more of an indistinct brown blob. The dice flew back to Humphrey's hand, and he returned them to his dimensional space as a column of light shot up from the circle. Sophie was already engaged with the approaching guards, while Clive and the two Onslows were blasting magical attacks past her. Behind them, monsters emerged from the light of Humphrey's summoning circle, one after another. There were crocodiles made of mud, anywhere from 5 to 7 meters long. Bone protruded all over their bodies, mostly taking the form of scales that looked less crocodilian and more draconic. The bone scales, as well as the long teeth, were all topped with panels and caps of enchanted metal. One of Humphrey's powers conjured basic magic items for each creature he summoned. Despite having legs, the mud monsters slithered forward on a slimy path, like fat snakes or speedy slugs. They left a trail of mud behind them as they moved to attack. The guards had the numbers initially, but the tables quickly turned as 20 of Humphrey's dragon bone mud crocodiles filled even the huge floor space of the dam's voluminous interior. The crocodiles didn't just clamp onto the dam guards, but dragged them to the ground and into a death roll, sucking them into the mud of their elemental bodies. In doing so, the bony scales passed through the bodies of the guards, who disappeared into the creatures and didn't come back out. Each monster had to pause and digest before moving on to the next victim. Only the bronze rank purity loyalists suffered this fate, although that was most of the guards. The silver rankers amongst them were strong enough to fend off or avoid the sluggish monsters, despite there being so many. Humphrey, Sophie, and Clive were much harder to avoid. At the other end of the dam, Belinda took frontline duties while Gary summoned an ally of his own. Using her ability to grow larger and stronger, she called up the heavy weapons and armor Gary had forged for her. Her Echo Spirit familiar, named Gemini at Jason's suggestion, mimicked her form and gear as it stood beside her. No longer bound by its iron rank limitations, Gemini now had physical substance and could even emulate some of Belinda's abilities. Behind the pair, Gary was calling out his own summoned entity. A singular entity, compared to Humphrey's small army, Gary's forge golem was a towering edifice of crude iron. A white-yellow glow shone from between the heavy panels that made up its lumbering body. It was neither quick nor agile, but it was massive, at almost twice Gary's height. While it was every bit as strong and resilient as it looked, even more impressive was its most powerful attack. The panels on its chest opened to reveal a cavity full of molten metal it could spray over enemies.
"This is wrong,"
Clive said, as he looked over a large device. They had fought their way partially along the dam, and Clive had stopped to sabotage a large piece of equipment that looked like an industrial pump into which someone had stabbed a bunch of huge crystals. "You can't sabotage it," Humphrey called back from amidst the ongoing combat. His summons were still fighting more of the purity loyalist guards alongside Sophie and Humphrey himself.
"I can sabotage it, sure," Clive said, "but this isn't doing what we thought it was. Not just that, anyway."
Humphrey drew back from the fight to speak with Clive, leaving Sophie and his monsters to hold the line.
"What do you mean?" Humphrey asked.
"Oh yeah, boys,"
Sophie yelled from the front, even as she continued acrobatically beating on the enemy.
"This is a great time to stop for a chat."
"Have you noticed that these guards are fighting tooth and nail, even though they're clearly outmatched?"
Clive said. A guard flew through the air, landing on the ground next to Clive. Immediately after, Sophie landed on the guard in a mount position and beat him in the face.
"No," she said, "I didn't notice that at all."
She backflipped off the guard, then kicked him derisively in the head before disappearing back into the melee.
"I think that whatever they're doing here," Clive said, "these guards are trying to buy time for them to at least partially finish it. I think the artificers are trying to accelerate the process taking place here."
"And what process is that?" Humphrey asked.
"I'm not sure," Clive said. "This whole dam should be collecting magic and using it to hide the valley and the purity loyalists in it. That's only consuming part of the collected magic, however. The rest is being collected and funneled somewhere else."
"For what?"
"I don't know," Clive said. "Somehow, though, even more power has started coming in from the valley, on top of what's being drawn from the river. I'm not sure of the source, but there's something off about it."
"Off?
How many times can I say I don't know?" Clive said. "I'd have to examine this setup for longer to figure out what's happening here."
"Oh, sure," Sophie said, as she sprang off the wall and kicked three people in the head before landing. "Take your time, it's fine."
"Actually, it's not," Clive said. "Give me a moment to sabotage this, and then we should get to the main infrastructure hub at the center of the dam as quickly as possible. We can't just stand around."
"Are you kidding me?"
After fighting their way through the middle of the dam, Humphrey, Sophie, and Clive found the others already waiting. Dead guards were strewn about, and they finally found the technicians who had fled earlier. Some were dead, while others had been strung up with rope and were being interrogated by Kenneth. Neil was making sure they survived the questions. Gary and his golem were clearing away bodies while Belinda examined a large magical device. It was large enough that it had clearly been constructed on site, but showed signs of recent and hasty modification. Parts had been crudely removed or added, and there were magical diagrams scrawled all over it in chalk.
"Took you long enough,"
Belinda said, not turning away from the device.
Were you just standing around talking the whole time?
Sophie flashed a glare at Clive and Humphrey.
No idea what you're talking about, Clive said as he joined Belinda. Any idea what they're up to?
I'm working on it, Belinda said. This is weird, right?
Yeah, Clive agreed. You saw the power being drawn in from the valley.
Yeah. I figured out that whatever's going on, we don't want it to, so I went ahead with the sabotage.
Same.
What's the source of power in the valley?
As far as we know, there shouldn't be anything in the valley that could produce the amount of power this place is drawing in. It has to have been brought in since we scouted the area out.
Belinda walked Clive through what she'd already learned examining the setup. The others quickly lost track of what they were talking about. The pair of magic experts pulled out various devices from their storage spaces as they tried to decipher the purpose of the huge device and its modifications. Sophie moved over to Ken and Neil as they brutally questioned a dangling artificer.
Get anything out of them? She asked.
The path of the zealot is a rigid one, Ken said. It affirms their resolve in times of trial, an admirable trait, but an impediment to our current endeavour.
He means no, Neil said.
They're not weak, I'll give them that.
That is what I just said, Ken told Neil.
And I translated it into the way normal people talk. Why does this group always need one guy who talks like he's from another world?
My manner of speech is rich with meaning and precise in that which it conveys, Ken said. Perhaps you should take the time to listen, instead of assuming that the people around you are simpletons.
That's not what...
Neil groaned and stomped off.
He misses Jason,
Gary said, approaching Sophie and Ken.
Such a tsundere.
You know I don't like that term, Sophie said.
That's because you are one, Neil called back.
You can participate in the conversation or go off and sulk, Sophie told him. You can't do both.
Watch me!
Gary poked the artificer dangling unconscious from an overhead beam.
Are you done with this one?
We are, Ken said. We'll continue through the remaining survivors, but I doubt that any will talk here. We'll take them back to the Adventure Society to be questioned properly. They'll break eventually.
Is this really necessary? Humphrey asked. He had been looking at the carnage with a grave expression.
Killing enemies is one thing, but torturing them is another.
What do you think is happening to people when you set them on fire with your abilities? Sophie asked him.
I know that, Humphrey said, but this doesn't feel right. Fighting the enemy is one thing, stringing up helpless people and making them suffer is another.
You're sweet,
Sophie said, placing a hand on his arm.
We're definitely torturing the evil zealots, though.
It won't be torture, Ken assured Humphrey, stepping out of a puddle of blood left by the man he'd just tortured into unconsciousness.
Torture is, as a means, unreliable and inconsistent. I've only taken this step here in the hope of extracting critical and timely information from people who do not want to give that information up. The Adventure Society has more humane and effective methods.
It's always easy to find an excuse, Humphrey said, stepping up into Ken's face. Your questions are over.
Belinda slid up to Sophie, speaking to her softly.
Is it just me, or does Humphrey get kind of sexy when he goes all ideological?
Oh yeah, Jason used to do it too, but he just came off as kind of a prick.
You know we're all silver rank, right? Neil asked. Just because you're whispering doesn't mean we can't hear you.
A blushing Humphrey desperately looked at Clive to change the subject.
What have you found? Humphrey asked him.
Clive glanced at Belinda, who shrugged back.
This place is collecting magic, Belinda said. We knew that going in. We thought it was all being used to hide the valley from magic detection, but that's only expending part of the power, the rest of which was being collected.
Like water behind a dam, Clive added.
This power source coming from the valley is very new, Belinda continued. It's not an ongoing source either. It came in one big lump, and the dam's magical processing is being used to refine it. This lump only came in a matter of hours ago. When we leaked the attack on the valley to potential Purity and Builder spies, it seems they immediately moved into the final phase of whatever their plan here was. They've been rushing to some final stage, where all the power from the dam and the valley is being sent out and used for... something.
Something?
The power collected here, Clive said, both from the dam itself and the valley, is being refined and then sent back to the valley for whatever is going on there.
A place where we sent a bunch of teams on a feint attack, Neil said.
Yes, Clive said. We have no idea what we've sent them into.
What about the original plan?
Humphrey asked. Can we still use the power flowing through here to blow the dam up and flood the valley? The team leaders all have magical devices to shield their teams from the floodwaters. Won't that stop whatever the Purity Church is up to? Even if we don't know what they're doing, Neil said, I'm fairly certain that stopping it is good for us.
There's not enough power left to destroy the dam, Belinda said. They've been sending it all into the valley for whatever they're doing. We can't repurpose that power from here anymore.
What can we do? Humphrey asked.
Well, Clive said, we think they need this central device to regulate the magic being fed to whatever is happening in the valley. We can't redirect it, but we could potentially disrupt it.
So, we could just hit this big magic thing a bunch, Sophie said.
We don't know what that would do, Clive said.
We know that it would make whatever's going on down there not go the way they want, Belinda said. I like the hitting it a bunch plan.
Again, Clive said, we don't know what that will do. It's reckless.
As is failing to act at all, Ken said.
It's happening right now, right? Gary said. If we're picking between what the evil zealots want and something else, without knowing what either choice is, then I choose the something else.
Humphrey turned to Ken. The Adventure Society put you in charge of this team, he said. The choice is yours. Stuff that, Sophie said. I say vote. Hands up who wants to smash the crap out of this thing. Her hand was joined in the air by Neil, Gary, and Belinda.
That's a majority, Belinda said.
Whatever the Adventure Society might say, your team is not mine to command, Ken said. Whatever you choose, I shall abide. And it seems that your members have spoken, Mr. Geller.
Great, Gary said, hefting his hammer. I've been wanting to hit these big magic machines since we got here, but Belinda wouldn't let me. I'm going to start with one of them big crystals.
In the mist-shrouded valley below the dam, a picturesque rural village was being splashed with blood and death. Purity loyalists were desperately defending against teams of adventurers.
Keep them away from the ritual site! It's almost complete!
As the battle raged, huge waves of magic surged from the woodland reaches of the valley. Transcendent lights of blue, silver, and gold rose out of the forest canopy at points up and down the valley. Each of the large magic conglomerations twisted into a ring shape that floated high in the sky. Streams of magic continued to rise, feeding the ring's power as huge portals opened within them. Winged angelic beings emerged from each of the portals, filling the sky like a plague of sexy, feathery locusts. The fighting below stalled as the battling forces watched the angelic creatures emerge. The adventurers were filled with confusion, and the Purity loyalists with triumph, until the streams of energy feeding the portals started to flicker and pulse. The portals became unstable, and the angelic creatures flew swiftly away from them even as more came through. Finally, the portals exploded. Violent eruptions of magic shot in every direction, turning angels into red mist and blasting craters in the ground. Adventurers and Purity faithful alike fled from wild blasts of magic, shrieking through the air and thundering into the ground. Everything turned to chaos and destruction as the ground was thrown up in clouds of dirt, shattered houses, and trees. Ear-tearing explosions smashed into the people on the ground and the angelic creatures in the air, their broken bodies raining from the sky. Eventually, the magic faded. The survivors had escaped, adventurers and Purity loyalists on the ground, and the angelic creatures through the sky. Dust clouds still lingered. Most of the village and the surrounding woods now a devastated moonscape of craters and desolation. Inside some of the craters, people regained consciousness, naked and hairless. These were not survivors of the battle, but civilians, somehow left behind in the wake of the exploding portal rings. One of these people was a man with chocolate skin and a pro-wrestler physique. He came to, the dirt scattered over him falling away as he stumbled groggily onto his feet. Looking himself over, he saw his nakedness and ran his hands over his bald head. He talked to himself, disoriented, his high-pitched voice incongruous with his imposing physique.
What the hell, bro? I'm in the Nicky New!
Chapter 34 I Liked the Fighting Better. Jason was once more riding a land skimmer along the road network that wove through the Palimustas equivalent of Central America. Each side of the broad thoroughfare was lined with dense jungle. According to his map, Jason was less than an hour from the final destination on his journey before he could portal back to Rimuros. Something twinged at his aura senses, so light that he wondered if he had imagined it. It was certainly closer than he wanted anything to get undetected. It could easily be an especially stealthy monster. If it was a gold-ranked one, he was in trouble, although sneaky monsters were typically less effective in an open fight. Jason blasted the area where he'd glimpsed the aura with a heavy fist of suppressive aura force, and his magic senses felt something break. Three figures in white outfits became visible by the side of the road. One of them swept a sword from which a blade of light shot out and split Jason's land skimmer in half. Jason landed lightly on the ground as the vehicle dissolved into his shadow. He conjured his blood robes and cloak around him as he looked at the three people. They all wore white leather armor, a man and a woman flanking a second woman in the middle who was clearly the leader. She was scabbarding the sword she had used to destroy Shade's vehicle form. All three had stark white hair and their auras read as human, despite the man amongst them having the slender frame and tapered ears of an elf. It wasn't just their armor that was white, but everything they were wearing, from the metal of their belt buckles to the blade of the woman's sword. Jason had only known one person to dress like that.
"You're as perceptive as promised, Asano," the woman in the lead said.
Jason's mind quickly processed what he was witnessing. The white clothes, knowing who he was and where he'd be. Along with making him realize something he should have already anticipated, it told him who they were and what they were doing.
"Purity Church," he said.
"The builder sent you."
"Laughably, the impure being is under restrictions as to who he can send after you."
"That's laughable. A bunch of purity adherents playing flunky to an impure being, and he's the one deserving of mockery?"
"None of his people could take you down under the restrictions he is under, because his filthy minions are weak. He made a concession to our principles, because we know exactly how to handle filthy little plague bringers that hide in the dark. And as you can see, we're all silver rank. There are only three of us, no overwhelming numbers, no excuses for your interdimensional friends to interfere in affairs that aren't theirs."
"That's funny, coming from someone shacked up with the builder. If I didn't..."
Sentence Jason suddenly opened a portal. The purity trio wasn't caught unaware. The subordinate woman threw an object as the portal arch rose from the ground. Jason dove for the portal, but the thrown object moved in a flash, a conjured chain wrapping around his body before vanishing.
"You have been affected by item, inescapable chains. Inescapable chains has been consumed to inflict inescapable. This effect ignores resistances."
Jason knew the affliction, as his own inexorable doom power could inflict the same one.
"Inescapable. Affliction. Magic. The subject cannot be affected by non-hostile teleport or dimension effects."
It rendered the portal in front of him useless and prevented him from shadow jumping. They had come prepared with an item that could negate one of Jason's most critical techniques. It passed straight through his powerful resistances to seal off any chance of easy escape, while also crippling his normal combat style. The trio looked at him smugly, still not moving to attack.
"You should just come quietly, Asano. You can't win. That agreement made on your behalf might stop us from using gold rankers, but there was nothing about very expensive and specialized items. They hid us from your senses and now have cut off your ability to run or hop around in the dark. Combined with our abilities, which already counter yours, you have no chance."
Jason winced under his hood without his enemy seeing. Trying to take him alive made what would come next a much trickier proposition.
"The builder wants me dead," Jason said.
"Going along quietly doesn't seem like a good choice for my long-term health."
"We have a use for you first. Come along and maybe you'll find a chance to escape, better than fighting and dying."
"I've been taken prisoner, and I've fought and died," Jason said as he conjured a dagger into his hand.
I liked the fighting better. The three purity loyalists all drew swords. No one moved as they continued to eye each other off. What does purity need with me?
You aren't worthy of our god's attention, Asano. One of our members needs you to be her worm on a hook.
There's a lot of that going around, Jason said and dashed forward. The three purity loyalists reacted swiftly, one of them throwing up a hand that flashed with blinding light.
You have been afflicted with flash blindness.
Being reliant on sight in the midst of combat was something Jason had been trained well beyond. His other senses painted a perceptual picture he had long used when his eyes were insufficient or deceived. The sound of the blade, the resonance of the magic passing through its enchanted metal, the feel of the air being displaced around him, and the intent in the auras too weak to hide from him. If anything, the impediment helped Jason slip into his combat trance state. Despite being one man with a knife against three people with swords, Jason held his own. Being surrounded by enemies was nothing new, and his powers and skills combined to make him supernaturally elusive. Shade's ability to suppress various giveaways prevented them from using the same sense as Jason did to read the battle. His cloak masked his movement, and feints made with his aura misled their magical senses. In many ways, Jason had blinded them more than they had him. Even attacks that should have landed missed as his cloak bent space around him. The bright swords of the purity loyalists flashed with rapid and precise movement, but it was as if they were stabbing at an empty cloud of darkness. On top of everything else, two of Gordon's orbs were intercepting attacks in shield form, buying Jason precious breathing room. Jason didn't pull out his familiars for different reasons. With Colin, he needed to maximize his regeneration until he had built up the effectiveness of his drain attack with afflictions. Also, Colin himself was very reliant on afflictions, and Jason wanted to diminish the resistances of the enemy before deploying him to full effect. There was also the risk that the enemy would have some countermeasure to the leech swarm. They knew his abilities and came prepared. They would be fools to ignore arguably his strongest trump card. Similar factors led him to retaining Gordon. Having Gordon not manifest meant that Jason could use a pair of much-needed shields, and Gordon added to Jason's already formidable aura strength. Jason was simultaneously suppressing three auras of his own rank, preventing three auras worth of benefits to the enemy and detriments to himself. These were not weak or inexpert auras either. Their solid control lacked weak points that made them easy to collapse. Only consistent pressure and raw strength got the job done. There was also the likelihood that the enemy had attacks that could hurt Jason's incorporeal familiars, Shade and Gordon both. Jason was saving Shade in case the fight went poorly and he needed to make an escape. Even with a combat trance pushing him to the limits of his capability, Jason was heavily pressured. Unable to shadow jump away, he stood his ground, every moment on a knife's edge. The trio of loyalists showed off exceptional training that marked them as elite adventurers on top of being religious zealots. For all that Jason's training had been diligent and exceptional, that of the purity adherents was no lesser. The difference between Jason and his opponents was the reason Rufus had founded a training annex in Greenstone. Elite adventurers from high magic zones trained in safety, too valuable to risk losing before they came into their true power. They were raised through the use of mirage chambers and carefully cultivated monster battles under the watchful eye of instructors. Jason, by comparison, had been fighting life and death battles from the beginning. Before he was an adventurer, before he was even Iron Rank, he had faced battles where he was unprepared, underpowered, outnumbered, and outmatched. Fighting on the knife's edge was a place where he knew how to stay balanced. Jason's cloak and senses were doing some heavy lifting as the four Silver Rank combatants flitted around one another like leaves in a wild gust. Jason's other abilities did not fare so well.
Special attack, punish, has inflicted sin, price of absolution, and wages of sin. Sin has been resisted and does not take effect. Price of absolution has been resisted and does not take effect. Wages of sin has been resisted and does not take effect.
Unsurprisingly, worshippers of purity had potent resistances. The only effects that managed to stick in the early stages of the fight were those that, like the affliction preventing Jason's shadow jumping, ignored those resistances. Each attack levied against Jason incurred the sin affliction from his aura. Unlike the same one from his special attacks, those afflictions went straight through their resistances. Further, each instance of sin on his enemies let Jason's aura diminish their resistances. One of the biggest problems that affected Jason when his afflictions were slow to build was that it hurt the effectiveness of his Amulet of the Dark Guardian. One of his most precious, useful items, he had earned it alongside the first scar on his soul, and its power grew with him over time. For every affliction Jason delivered, the amulet gave him a shield that could absorb damage, and, after it had, became a short-lived healing effect. Each shield and heal was weak, but Jason normally output a vast number of afflictions. The rapid acquisition and expenditure of his shields was a critical buffer to Jason's ability to endure hits. Without it, Jason was working with a much smaller margin of error. The Loyalists would not stand around and wait for Jason to build up power, however, and they had abilities of their own. Using their numbers to pressure Jason, they positioned him to suffer attacks that couldn't be avoided through small evasive motions. Waves of searing light and short-lived, conjured sword squalls burned and cut. Even with all his evasiveness, the swords of the enemy still managed to land some magic-infused attacks. The enemy was too skilled to dance in Jason's hand. Jason couldn't avoid everything and was struck by savage special attacks that burned his flesh and even dispelled his cloak. He suffered extra hits even in the brief moment it took to conjure it again. Although his regeneration was potent, Jason was not building up fast enough. Without afflictions properly landing on his enemies, his drain attacks were too weak. Without the ability to jump out of the combat, he couldn't buy a moment to cast a more powerful drain spell. Even if he could have, its effectiveness would likewise suffer from the same absence of afflictions. Although it was looking bad, hope was far from snuffed out. Not every affliction fell short, especially as the resistance of his enemies slowly dropped.
Special attack, Leech Bite, has inflicted bleeding, leech toxin, and tainted meridians. Bleeding is already in effect. Bleeding has been refreshed. Price of absolution has been resisted and does not take effect.
Tainted Meridians was one of Jason's silver rank afflictions that had seen little use as it had minimal impact on monsters that used mana in a different way than essence users. Landing the affliction on his current enemies was much more useful.
Tainted Meridians. Affliction. Poison. Subject stamina and mana cost for magical abilities are increased. The effect of drain abilities used on them is increased. Bleed effects on them cause mana loss commensurate with blood loss.
Jason's only realistic chance at winning the fight was to outlast his enemies, but Silver Rankers had no shortage of endurance. The Tainted Meridian's afflictions would accelerate the clock Jason needed to run out. Tainted Meridians marked the turning point in the fight. Jason's afflictions finally bit as he continued to clash with the Loyalists. Dark blood and jagged rents marred their once pristine white armor. Jason was bloodied himself, but it was soaked up by his robes or hidden by his cloak while he was healing. The enemy had been healing as well, at the start having their own passive regeneration. Now that afflictions were taking hold, bleed effects were soaking the healing and leech toxin was refreshing the bleeds as the healing consumed them. As the fight dragged on, his enemies grew weaker as Jason grew stronger. He was about to move the fight into a new phase and start draining afflictions when his enemies beat him to it. One member of the trio created a magical dome around the three of them.
Gordon, Jason said.
His familiar appeared and immediately blasted the barrier with 6 beams of energy specialized in breaching magic. Even so, the barrier was resilient, being a channeled ability. Channeling powers required the user to give up any other active abilities, but the power was worth the inconvenience when used well. The barrier was used very well, showing off the trio's teamwork. The moment it went up, the leader chanted a spell incantation that chilled Jason to the bone. The last time he had heard that spell was the very first time he fought a Silver Ranker, also from the Church of Purity. He remembered its effects, which were a bane to almost every combat power Jason had. Jason realized that when they claimed their powers counted his, it had been no empty boast. A cleansing light washed out of the barrier, through his enemies, and then through him.
All of your afflictions on Purity Priest have been cleansed by an effect that ignores all cleanse prevention. All of your afflictions on Purity Adherent have been cleansed by an effect that ignores all cleanse prevention. All of your afflictions on Purity Adherent have been cleansed by an effect that ignores all cleanse prevention. All of your boons and the boons on your items have been negated by an effect that ignores dispel prevention.
At the same time, the third loyalist cast a slow but powerful healing spell to follow up. With Jason's afflictions gone, it took full effect, erasing all the damage Jason had done. In moments, everything Jason had accomplished in the fight was washed away. He didn't hesitate, recalling Gordon and having shade bodies flood out between himself and the barrier. This was the contingency for which Jason had been holding shade. Jason burned a large chunk of his mana to manifest starlight cloaks all over the shade bodies, then disappeared amongst them. His aura vanished, the enemy still inside the barrier losing all track of him. The one advantage Jason gained from his enemies bottling themselves up was that it finally gave him a chance to break away. The shade bodies, Jason amongst them, dove into the jungle and scattered. The incorporeal creatures were unimpeded by the thick Panamanian jungle, and Jason was not much worse off. His cloak bent space, not to ward off attacks, but to allow him to slip easily through the dense jungle growth. The shades, and Jason alike, melted into the shadows cast by the thick canopy overhead. If he could play hide and seek long enough in the jungle, Jason could wait out the duration of the affliction blocking his ability to portal away to safety. The auras of Jason's enemies moved closer. He sensed them flying over the jungle. His own flight power was mediocre and unlikely to match their speed. As for staying in the jungle, even slipping through the growth like a ghost couldn't outpace their flying over it. He slowed down enough that the remaining shades he hadn't sent out could muffle the sound of his passage through the harsh terrain. Tiny, bird-shaped lights came darting through the canopy, like phosphorescent hummingbirds, banishing the shadows around them. They spread out in a sweeping arc, quickly revealing which of the shadowy figures moving through the jungle were decoys. Jason kept moving, but the glowing birds were both very fast and very numerous, tracking him down in far less time than he was happy with. He called out two of Gordon's orbs, using them to shoot down the birds as they lit up his hiding places, but more quickly came. It was evident from the auras converging on him that the birds were giving away his position the moment their light fell on him. Running out of options, he blasted the light birds closest to him to restore the shadows, and then dove into a thick mud pit. Unfortunately, the three Purity Loyalists were not the Predator, and Jason was not Arnold Schwarzenegger. While the conjured birds were deceived, the Loyalists were not fools. They realized Jason had to be hiding to escape the reach of the birds and swept his last confirmed area. They slowed their flight and brought out what looked like miners' lanterns, if miners were extravagantly wealthy and made their tools from silver and gold. They slowly panned over the jungle with beams from the lanterns. Jason had no doubt this was another item procured to overcome one of his advantages, likely Shade's ability to mask his presence from various means of detection. This aspect of the familiar's power was more versatile than strong, so Jason was sure a specialized tool would penetrate it. Jason was running out of options. It was coming down to luck. As he waited for a chance to sneak away in a moment he was overlooked or the sweeping beams passed him by, the moment didn't come. One beam, then a second, and third settled on him. Moments later, his three pursuers descended through the jungle canopy on wings of light. Lying filthy in the mud, Jason glared up at the three loyalists.
"Look at you," the leader said. "It was always going to come to this."
Jason got to his feet and conjured his blade. "It always does," he said, flashing a savage, bloody grin before it disappeared into his hood as he conjured up another cloak. The leader sighed.
"Very well," she said. "Melody will have to be disappointed. Kill him."
Chapter 35. That usually is my day. The Gold Rankers, secretly trailing Jason, watched with surprise as three people appeared out of nowhere.
"This is it,"
Liara Rimaros said. She was with two members of her old team, from when she had been a restricted essence user enforcer for the Adventure Society. Like many Gold Rankers, the current disposition of their team wasn't about everyday monster hunting, because there weren't enough Gold Rank monsters to hunt with the power to push them closer to Diamond. Most Gold Rankers didn't even chase after Diamond Rank. Those that did, like Ymir's teammate Callum, spent much of their time in extremely high magic zones. These were places where the average power of monster manifestations excluded all but a few specialized population centers. These were wild frontier towns, where even silver rankers were asking for death by roaming without protection. Gold rankers in civilized society pursued more civilized agendas. It might be mastering a craft, founding a township, garnering political influence, or duty to a nation or guild. Their teams came together at need, whether for the occasional monster hunt or to assist a member with their individual goals. With lifespans extending into centuries, monster surges often served as reunions. Liara had needed to make sure that neither Jason nor anyone waiting to ambush him would detect his observers. With her team in the city for the surge, she had access to people whose abilities she knew and trusted. Yana and Ledev were a brother and sister pair that, along with Liara herself, had made the hunter component of their specialized hunter-killer team. Together, they had been following Jason from the moment he left the airship.
"Do we move in?"
Yana asked.
"Let's wait and see what happens," Liara said. "Surprisingly, they're only silver rank, so we can afford to let it play out."
They listened to the conversation between Jason and what turned out to be purity loyalists, instead of the expected builder cultists.
"Who could possibly put restrictions on the builder that it would adhere to?" Ledev asked. "And why would they do it for this guy?"
"They intend to take him alive," Liara said. "That's better than we hoped for. It means we don't have to intervene to save him, and we can track them back to their nest."
The three purity adherents hovered in the air above Jason. They had little room to move under the jungle canopy, even if the wings of light holding them aloft were intangible and unaffected by the trees. Jason knew that even though it was tactically unsound, his enemies couldn't resist the chance to look down on him. Being one himself, he could easily spot a showboat. Unleashing his aura, Jason didn't suppress all three but focused on the leader. His power gripped her like a fist crushing an egg, and he unleashed a soul attack that left her face twisted in a silent scream. The attack on their leader gave the others pause for only a fleeting moment, but it was a moment Jason ruthlessly took advantage of. A shadowy arm shot out, grabbed the stricken leader, and dragged her out of the sky. Jason tossed her into the mud pit that he had just climbed out of, and the mud immediately roiled madly like a bubbling cauldron. The mud wasn't boiling, it was filled with leeches that immediately inundated the leader, her already dirty armor now painted in dark, clingy mud. The leeches dug into her flesh. They wriggled through the rents left in her armor by Jason's dagger and squirmed into her boots and sleeves, clamping onto any exposed skin. Lamprey teeth dug into her hands, face, even her eyelids, as she thrashed to get out and free of the tiny carnivores. The other two zealots were only startled for the briefest of intervals. They weren't shocked into anything as stupid as freezing in place and calling out their leader's name in anguish. Trusting their leader to handle her own problems, they turned their focus on Jason and moved to the attack. The less than ideal tactical positioning of the zealots bought Jason time as he ducked into the jungle, his cloak's displacement power allowing him to slip through the dense jungle. The undergrowth offered little impediments to his enemies, who smashed forward with silver rank strength in pursuit, but it was delay enough to buy Jason precious moments. He had the time to pull a potion vial from his belt and swig the contents as he fled. It was a general power-enhancing potion that boosted his basic attributes. This gave the same comprehensive enhancement as a spirit coin, but instead of a sudden spike in power, it was a smoother, more extended boost. While it wouldn't take his abilities into the gold rank range the way a spirit coin would, the effects would last much longer, with far less debilitating after effects. It was a highly expensive potion. The silver rank variant cost more than the gold rank coin it was roughly comparable to. Jason was not short on money, however, and his current situation was more than desperate enough to warrant the price. Jason had a brief window while the strongest member of the enemy trio was caught up extracting herself from a pit of Colin. Silver Rankers moved fast, and her companions were crashing through the jungle while Jason barely had time to get the potion down. They came charging through the undergrowth like rhinos, but rather than flee, Jason moved to meet one. They crashed together. Using her own charge to get inside her sword reach, he rammed home his dagger. In the terrain, Jason's short dagger was far better than the zealot's swords, and he jammed it right into the throat of the woman that slammed into him. Impaling the throat of a silver ranker was far from enough to kill them, or even impede them that much, but Jason knew from experience that there was more to it than that. Outside of protection specialists, very few people, even at silver rank, had suffered the kind of countless attacks that came with Jason's self-healing combat style. For all his evasion techniques, every time he slipped up, misread an attack, or was simply outplayed, his body had paid the price. His experience had allowed him to move past instinctive reactions to wounds that, even to a bronze ranker, were critical. His opponent lacked this experience, and couldn't help but clutch at her savagely pierced neck. Jason's experience was his strongest advantage against enemies that were well-trained, but hadn't spent their entire careers going from one life-and-death battle to the next. One of the lessons that came from walking that line over and over was the difference between victory and defeat often came down to just a few critical moments. This was why Jason worked so hard to buy even fragments of time, and strove to make the most of each. He had bought one moment with his aura attack, another with his dive into the jungle, and the zealots handed over a third with their poor positioning. With each one, he'd bought a key advantage, boxing up the leader, boosting his power, and seizing the initiative. Now was his moment to own the fight. Jason positioned himself between the two zealots and a nest of shadow arms snaked out of his cloak to entangle the loyalist that didn't have a gaping wound in his neck. At the same time, Jason landed more attacks on the one he'd already stabbed, sewing machine pricks, quick and shallow, as he tried to load her up with afflictions. Even with his boosted power, though, the results were patchy at best. His resistance suppression powers were weaker at a baseline level than the purity zealot's resistances. Despite snatching the battle's momentum, Jason was in a bad way. He had been about to replenish his reserves in the first stage of the fight when the shield delayed him. The powerful heal and purge powers used within that shield turned delay into denial. Jason was left ragged and spent while his enemies were fully healed and free of the afflictions on which Jason's powers relied. The only measure by which they remained depleted was their mana supply. Shade emerged from the jungle, reconverging after scattering in Jason's failed attempt at escape. The familiar couldn't physically hurt the silver rankers, but his ability to drain mana attacked their biggest current weakness. Jason had a small window in which he had the edge, between the absent leader, his potion-boosted power, and his control of the fight's momentum. He had, while it lasted, to redo all the gains the purge spell had wiped away. He gave it his all, snatching every moment and seizing every advantage in a desperate attempt to turn his current momentum into victory. Every trick and every tool were used. He threw out darts that created shadows, explosions, and decoy auras. One type entangled the enemies in vines, which was especially effective in their present terrain. He even pulled out an electricity gun, half-melted from overuse. It wasn't powerful enough to inflict real damage, but the surprise factor of an attack so removed from his abilities was one more advantage he could make use of. He wasn't willing to give any of them up as he scraped the barrel for everything he had. It wasn't enough. Resetting Jason's buffs and afflictions at the moment he was at his lowest and about to replenish himself had reset a battle already stacked against him to an even more lopsided starting point. All his skills, tools, tactics, and powers could accomplish no more than forestalling the inevitable. Jason's enemies couldn't match his experience or skill, but the difference was a matter of degrees, not orders of magnitude. The zealots were highly capable, with an abundance of resolve. They didn't let Jason's cockroach survivability diminish their patience and push them into sloppy mistakes. While they might not have Jason's experience with life and death battles, they did understand oppression. They knew well that patience would inevitably give them victory. The leader escaped Colin, her powerful resistances shrugging off almost all the poison the toothy leeches inflicted. The game familiar continued to hold her up for a while, taking his blood clone form and binding her up in strips of bloody cloth. Eventually, though, she burned most of his body mass away with searing light and joined her companions. Shade had likewise taken hits for the team. As Jason had feared, his opponents had attacks that could cut down Shade's incorporeal forms. When only a few remained, Jason recalled them. Like the portion of Colin's biomass Jason always retained, it was enough to reconstitute them both without the need to resummon them. Gordon was already stashed away because he didn't have extra bodies to lose. Jason also needed the shields from the borrowed orbs. Jason had made impressive headway in afflicting the two enemies he confronted himself. It was a struggle between his ability to impart his various maladies and their ability to resist and purge them. Being purity worshippers wasn't for nothing, and they both had cleansing powers, although Jason was able to impede them. The silver rank effect of his inexorable doom spell was an additional affliction that helped lock the other maledictions in place.
Persecution, affliction, curse, stacking. Subject gains resistance to incoming boon, recovery, cleanse, and heal over time effects. These resistances cannot be voluntarily lowered. Additional instances have a cumulative effect.
Even with his advantages, Jason felt the momentum turn against him like a vast ocean vessel, slowly but unstoppably changing course. Purity's most zealous worshippers had too many purgation tools at their disposal, both abilities and items. Their teamwork let one cover the other to drink a quick potion. As a result, Jason hadn't done enough by the time the clock ran out. The leader joined her companions just as the effect of Jason's potion was coming to an end. His temporary strength turned to weakness, nowhere near the after effects of a spirit coin, but still damning in his current circumstance. He was too weak to fight all three, and he couldn't have outrun them at his best. He'd failed to turn the fight around or drag it out long enough that he could once again use his portal. The portal he opened was still in place, back on the road. The other end was in his cloud house. Jason had been hoping that Rufus and Farah would come through from the other side. It was a slender hope, though, as they had missions of their own. Neither would slack off during a monster surge. In the end, Jason was tired and hurt, weak and ragged. Even so, he kept fighting. Futile as it was, he'd reached his desperate bottom line, but they wouldn't be able to catch him without killing him.
"What is he doing?"
Ledev asked as he watched from high in the air with Liara and Yana.
"He knows they want him alive, so why would he fight to the death?"
"Because he knows we're here," Liara said.
"There's no way he sensed us," Ledev said.
"He didn't," Liara said. "The purity loyalists showed him we were here."
"They don't know either," Yana said.
"They didn't have to," Liara explained. "Asanu is aware that we know how the Builder's people react to him. He knows we have access to his assigned route. He also knows that if anyone can find people suspected of working with the Builder to leak information to, it's the Anti-Builder Task Force. As soon as these people were waiting for him, he realized that we were fishing for cultists with him as bait. He even said as much."
"He thinks we'll step in and save him,"
Yana realized.
"Forget it," Ledev said. "He thinks he can force our hand, but if he wants to die, let him. It's more valuable to follow them back to their people than tip our hand."
"We can't just let him die," Yana said. "I'm going to help him, Led, and so are you."
"Fine," Ledev groaned.
"There is more to Asanu than I've been allowed to tell you," Liara said. "I think the lengths the Builder is going to over one silver ranker makes that plain enough. Even if he weren't, though, we placed Asanu in this situation. We're taking him back out of it."
Jason could barely stay on his feet, but his strange eyes were alive as they glared at the zealots from the darkness of his hood. Even run ragged, Jason was making the purity adherents pay a higher price than they wanted to take him down. They thought it was the last prideful gasp of a dying man, unaware he was waiting for someone else to make themselves known. While he remained defiant, he was starting to worry that they either weren't there after all, or would just let him die. Then three gold rank auras locked into the Purity Loyalists. The Purity people didn't go easy, but the gold rankers and their surprise attacks took them prisoner, hurt but alive. After making sure the trio were thoroughly locked up in suppression gear, Liara, Ledev, and Yana dragged them back to the road. Jason was leaning heavily against a black land skimmer, covered head to toe in mud, blood, and exhaustion. With Colin's biomass severely depleted, Jason was reduced to drinking a healing potion, and it wasn't his first. He'd taken 3 of healing and 2 of mana in as quick a succession as he could without poisoning himself.
"I'm an idiot," he said. "I should have seen this coming from the moment you saw those builder cultists react."
Ledev and Yana threw curious glances at Liara.
"They don't know,"
Jason realized, watching Liara's teammates.
"They're not in the anti-builder unit.
Are they your own team?"
The stealth specialists revealed nothing from their auras, but lacked Liara's political training to mask body language.
"They are your team," Jason said. "This is a private thing."
"Oh, crap. The old man really is deciding whether to..."
"Yes," Liara said, cutting him off. That told Jason more about how much Yana and Ledev knew.
"You really think I'd go along with that?" Jason asked. "Especially after today."
Ledev's face filled with growing disapproval as he listened to Jason and Liara talk.
"You're speaking with a princess of this Storm Kingdom," he told Jason. "You need to address her with respect."
"Respect is earned," Jason said wearily. "And lost." Ledev opened his mouth to retort, but stopped at a gesture from Liara.
"You knew we were here," Yana said. "If you'd gone quietly, we could have tracked them back to their base and then rescued you."
"Yeah," Jason said, "because that's what selling me out to the Builder cult engenders. Trust."
"I know we haven't treated you well here, Mr. Asano," Liara said.
"I spotted that too," Jason said, "but I won't claim to be innocent of using others without thinking of the consequences."
He frowned, then narrowed his eyes at Liara.
"Except you did think about it, didn't you?
By now, you must know pretty much everything I've ever done in this world. You'll know that I have a history of reacting badly when powerful people try to use me. You want to see if I've learned better. Except it's not you, the old man is having me tested, and not just by you. Do say hello to Trenchant when you debrief him."
"You think you warrant that kind of attention and effort?"
"You're here, aren't you?"
"You think very highly of yourself," Ledev said.
"That's not news to anyone," Jason said. "And I never asked for all that effort. I was looking for a nice, quiet stay in your very lovely kingdom."
"There are no quiet stays in a monster surge," Yana said.
"It depends on your standards. By mine, a monster surge is pretty relaxing. The builder invasion will be rough, though, I'll give you that."
"You think a monster surge is relaxing?"
Yana asked.
"Sure," Jason said. "You've got the Adventure Society and all these gold and diamond rankers to save the world, so you don't have to do it yourself. They have a great spice market on Unknot. I'm going to put together a mix for cheese enchiladas when I get back."
"You are right that I've learned a lot about you," Liara said. "And today I learned more. People the Builder wants to kill personally don't get nice and quiet, Mr. Asano."
"Then you should check my files again. He's already killed me personally, and it didn't take. Now he's sending henchmen. He has no idea how to Dark Lord properly. He's doing it all backwards."
"You and I need to have a long talk, Mr. Asano."
"No, we don't, Princess of the Storm Kingdom. You just want to."
He let out a long sigh. "Look, I'm tired and I still have a job to do, so I'm going to make my last delivery and go home. Come find me in Rimuros and maybe I'll muster up the energy to get angry and say something stupid. I have a lot of practice."
"That's it?"
Yana asked. Jason gave her a quizzical look.
"That's what?"
"An organization key to orchestrating an interdimensional invasion is targeting you specifically for death. You barely survived the ambush, and you're just going to, what, go about your day?"
Jason gave her a tired but friendly smile.
Lady, that usually is my day. If I stopped working every time some evil church or the local magic society director had me kidnapped, I'd never get anything done. This was meant to be a nice break for me, where people like you deal with the global conspiracies and forces from beyond reality. But your princess here went and hung a pork chop around my neck. Now I'm going to be hip deep in zealots, cultists, and evil magic robots from space. Again. Jason opened the door of the skimmer and slumped into the back seat.
You can't just leave, Ledev said. We're not done with you.
You're bloody right you're not, Jason said, without turning around to look. You people are following me until I'm done in case someone else tries to kidnap me. You're the ones who told these pricks where to find me after all. We're only an hour out of the next fort town anyway.
Ledev looked incredulously at the top of Jason's head, laid back on the plush seat of the skimmer. He opened his mouth to talk, but again Liara silenced him, putting a restraining hand on his shoulder.
That's fine, she said. We owe you that much.
Jason sat up, turned, and gave Liara a long, assessing look. Unlike the others, he could not read her sincerity or lack thereof at all. He gave her a small nod, turned back, and waved his hand forward. The land skimmer started moving, soon zipping away down the road. Ledev's face still showed his anger at Jason's insolence, while Yana looked skeptical and confused.
Did he say he was kidnapped by a magic society director? And what's a robot?
Chapter 36. Unyielding Faith. What had once been an idyllic, mist-shrouded valley was now a bombed-out wasteland of craters, broken buildings, and broken bodies. The mist had faded away, the air now filled with an ozone tingle of lingering magic and the iron taste of blood. Little more than a few buildings, lucky to have even one wall left standing, was all that remained of the village. Adventure Society and Magic Society personnel swarmed what was left like ants on a corpse. The Adventure Society staff were mostly hauling away the dead, piled onto wagons that floated over ground too rough for wheels. The Magic Society investigators were conducting magical analysis, even as the dead were being carted off around them. While the adventurers who had participated in the battle had casualties, they had managed to avoid all but a few fatalities. The Purity Loyalists had more fallen amongst their number, but most of the dead were the angel-like beings that had come through the sky portals. Torn apart and dropped out of the sky, large portions of their bodies had been annihilated, leaving only macabre remnants behind.
They call themselves messengers, Clive explained, as he and the rest of the group picked their way through the carnage. They're too inherently magical to use essence magic, and they aren't native to our world.
Your sister can summon one, right, Humphrey?
Belinda asked. Humphrey's sister, Henrietta, was a summoning specialist, with an array of summoning abilities and familiars. It was an unusual specialty that made her something of a one-woman team.
That isn't a true messenger, Clive said. Messengers are living things from physical reality. A summoning ability essentially creates a controlled monster. It might have the shape and the power, but it's not the real thing.
Is that what happened here? Neil asked. Some kind of mass summoning?
No, Clive said. If the messengers here were just summoned fakes, the dead ones would be going up in rainbow smoke by now. Those rings were portals bringing the messengers from somewhere. Even with the kind of magic that dam had gathered up, it shouldn't be possible.
Jason came here, Sophie pointed out. Twice.
These are not ordinary times, Ken said.
Exactly,
Clive agreed.
This monster surge is unlike anything we've ever seen. It is a time where the impossible has become possible, at least for a while. Every surge weakens the dimensional wall between our universe and the deep astral, but this time it's been shredded. It will take a while to repair itself. Until it does, we've got the worst monster surge in recorded history to deal with, plus whatever manages to invade through the gaps, first the Builder, and now these messengers.
Which leads to the question of their intent, Ken said. The Builder's purpose is clear, to plunder our astral spaces. What do these new beings want?
All the ones that survived flew away, Humphrey said. We'll find out when some of them are captured.
We already know what they want, Gary said. They were called here by purity extremists. They're going to declare everyone and everything they don't like to be unclean and try to wipe it off the face of the planet.
There has always been a question as to why purity chose to take a part in this affair, pitting itself against the entire world, with only something it should detest as an ally. Perhaps we finally caught a glimpse of their ultimate objective.
Even if as many as those messengers came through the rings as the Valley teams reported, Humphrey said, that's not enough for the Purity Church to take on a whole world full of adventurers and other churches.
You're assuming this is the only place they're doing it, Clive said. We forced their hand here, and they opened the portals ahead of plan. What if there are places like this all over the world? What if they were waiting for the conflict with the Builder to reach full swing before swooping in with a global army of messengers?
Why would these messenger things participate? Neil asked. What's in it for them?
And why are they called messengers? Sophie asked. What's the message and who is it from?
What I'm about to say is generalizing, Clive said. Very broadly, since we're talking about a people spread across multiple realities, they are one of the few intelligent beings known for interdimensional travel as a culture. It's the main reason they are so well known.
We get it, Belinda said. It's not a research paper, Clive. You can just explain things without needing to qualify every detail.
Fine, Clive said. By and large, messenger culture has a single unifying idea, that they are the highest form of life and that they represent the will of the living cosmos.
The cosmos is alive? Humphrey asked.
Not that I'm aware of, Clive said.
Since when does something not being true stop people from believing in it? Neil asked.
Very true, Ken agreed. Once